Well, good evening and welcome to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw and I'm very excited about what we're going to do this evening. Our first hour, we're going to have Dr. Michael Kaufman, who's going to talk with us about the land use element of sustainable development and how the Wildlands Project works with the Smart Growth Project to restructure how American people are going to be living over the next decades. And in the second, since 1992 has been helping citizens across America understand the dangers of the environmental movement and how they're being justified as a reason for a need for world government and world religion. He's the author of three books, Environmentalism, The Dawn of the Aquarius, or The Twilight of a New Dark Age, Saviors of the Earth, The Politics and Religion of the Environmental Movement, and most recently, his book is called The Birth of World Government, Saviors of the Earth. Well, Michael Kaufman has a BS degree in forestry, an MS in biology, and a PhD in forest science from the University of Idaho. He is a respected scientist and ecologist who's been involved in ecosystem research for over 20 years in both academia and industry, so he comes to this discussion tonight very well prepared about what's going on our rural lands here in America. Michael, are you with us?
I am.
Well, it's good to hear your voice. And,
good to hear you too, Michael.
It's we're from coast to coast here, from Santa Cruz, California, to Bangor, Maine. You can't get much further apart than that. But it's amazing the similarities between what goes on here and what's going on there. Is that a fair
statement? That's very true. It's happening all across this country, and I think we need to recognize that there is a major effort underway to basically control not only rural people, but people that are living in urban and suburban areas as well.
Well, I think I think that's the emerging understanding that people need to come to. The smart growth programs here in Central California, we had on our ballot, every county had a massive sales tax for a new transportation system. And those who understand the sustainable development or smart growth element behind that can understand what kind of raiding of our treasury and reinstituting of our infrastructure that these boondoggles mean. But not many people are able to connect these urban restructurings with the Wildlands program that we've all seen go on for the last 10 to 15 years in the Pacific Northwest and certainly up in northern Maine and in places in between all across the country.
That's true, and really it doesn't have a natural connection unless you understand the agenda behind both the Wildlands program and smart growth. Let me just explain very quickly. During the 1980s, I was involved in a multi-million-dollar research effort, actually coordinating it, to look at the issues of acid rain, global climate change, biodiversity loss, and a variety of other things. And in that process, began to realize that there was a huge agenda out there. That's what made me tumble onto the Wildlands Project in the late 1980s, and was involved in trying to get it stopped prior to 1992 when it was introduced as the Convention on Biological Diversity in the Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit in 1992. Bush did not sign that. Clinton did, and we were able to stop it just an hour before it was to be ratified in 1994 during Clinton's administration.
Now,
primarily,
let me understand
Michael.
This, Michael.
What's that?
You're talking about the Biodiversity Treaty.
Yes.
As opposed to the Rio Accords themselves.
Well,
hold that answer for 1 second. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Well, welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm with Dr. Michael Kaufman, And we're discussing the 1992 Rio Conference, which is set upon the world two important documents, one called the Rio Accords or Agenda 21. That was signed by then-President George Bush. And now we're talking about the Biodiversity Treaty that was not signed by President Bush but was signed by Clinton shortly thereafter.
That's right. It was sent to the U.S. Senate for ratification for a year, and it came out in August of 1994 for full ratification. We got it derailed then. I can't go into the details as to how we did that at this point. And then in September, we finally killed it when we demonstrated that the heart of the Convention on Biological Diversity was the Wildlands Project, which intended to set aside one half of the United States into wilderness corridors and reserves.
Now, Michael, if you'd come to me in 1994 and said that that's what was going to happen, most people sitting in my shoes would have thought that was nuts.
Absolutely, and I agree. It was a very hard sell. In fact, in July of 1994, there was three of us that went to the Congress and stumped the halls of Congress for 2 weeks trying to convince the U.S. Senate that this is what it was, and it wasn't until mid-August when we were sent information from the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, which originally wrote the Convention on Biological Diversity, a document called the Global Biodiversity Assessment that basically said that it was the Wildlands Project upon which they had to depend in order to protect biological diversity. And once we introduced that into Congress, we did that the day that they were supposed to ratify it, they realized that they had been taken to the cleaners by the United Nations, and as a consequence, it was Senator Mitchell, who was the majority leader at the time, he pulled it from the executive calendar. It was never voted on because we had been in his office just a few weeks before that showing him what this Wildlands Project would do, setting aside half of the United States in the wilderness areas for the sole purpose of protecting biological diversity. The other half was to be highly regulated. And that's where the whole smart growth issue comes in. And we need to understand that not only do they want to set half of the United States into wilderness, kick people off the land, uproot highways, and so forth, but they then had in mind of managing, micromanaging all development, all land use, and so forth over the remaining half of the United States. Recognize that only less than about 2.5% of the American landscape is actually has 77% of the American population. Wow. Let me put it a different way.
Hold that thought for a second, Michael.
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm Michael Shaw with Michael Kaufman, and we are discussing the Biodiversity Treaty, what it was intended to do in 1994, and how it was rejected by the U.S. Senate at that time. And it was very draconian in its restructuring of American society. Is that a fair statement?
Very, very much so. It is, in fact, it is still progressing very rapidly, even though it was not ratified in the Senate.
Now, how does that get to be?
Well, President Clinton set into motion a series of things by executive order, by setting aside land and so forth for roadless areas, 60 million acres. The non-governmental organizations are spending hundreds of millions of dollars a year on either conservation easements or outright sales. The various governmental organizations are developing different regulations to prohibit landowners from using their lands in any way except for maintaining basically wildland features.
And let me pause for a minute there just to give a concrete for our local audience here in Santa Cruz. Boy, that's evidencing itself in so many ways. The Resource Conservation District, as an example, which is an offshoot of the Federal Department of the Interior, went from budget when I was on that board of about $10,000 or $15,000 a year to multi-millions today. And they coordinate foundation monies and NGO monies, and they are coming up with what they call is a streamlined regulatory system that will manage everything that you would want to do on rural lands. And much of it's been implemented in piecemeal fashion by a compliant board of supervisors, but the rules for this area, and I know the rules up around King County up in Washington, and made a lot of news lately about how they've passed an ordinance that says that 65% of rural owners' land has to be held in perpetuity to a non-used condition. Is this the kind of thing you're talking about?
It's exactly the kind of thing that I'm talking about. And we have to understand, and I'm going to go through this a little bit slow just so that you can keep up with it. I also teach world history as a kind of a side thing. I just feel that it's necessary to somehow teach some of the students what's been happening. And what we're witnessing here in the United States is a transition from unalienable property rights and other civil rights to what are called usufructuary rights. Now, actually, that was part of the Convention on Biological Diversity that we happened to spot right at the last minute. I didn't even know what it meant. I had to look it up. And it basically means the Caesar owns everything. And it actually developed in Rome back during the times of the Roman Empire, and it was an allocation of land rights out to soldiers and other people who were beneficiaries of the pleasure of the Caesar, in order to reward them for their services. And they were able to use the land, but only as directed by the government or the Roman Empire. And this is exactly what is happening here in the United States, and it's spelled out in the Convention on Biological Diversity, that we have to transist from the concept of unalienable property rights to these usufructuary rights, where the state basically controls everything the landowner would like to do.
Well, let's take that a little further. I like to use some simpler words. Unalienable means natural, means it's inherent to your being. So we're talking about rights that don't come from another man, that are part of our nature, imbued by God, imbued by our Creator. Or we're talking about granted rights, where guys more powerful than ourselves decide what our rights in life and to life and about life are to be.
Exactly.
And that's what we're talking about here in switching the premise upon which land is managed. But it's not just land management. It is all things, including our persons, that become subject to that that philosophical premise, the whole sustainable development movement is predicated upon.
Absolutely. And we've got to understand the enormous implications involved in what you just said, Michael, because what we're witnessing is that if you read the writings of our founders and so forth, and many of the historians, writers, philosophers through time, what you find is that property, or the property rights, not the property itself, but the property rights, the right to use the land, is essential for our basic liberties and freedom. Without it, we will not have liberty and freedom, because whoever owns the property or controls the property, which is rapidly becoming the government, controls the person who lives on that property. And that was the essence of the Soviet Union back prior to its dissolving in the early 1990s. People were not controlled by the KGB, much to the surprise of most Americans. They were controlled by their local Commissar, who had the absolute authority to throw them out on the street, out of their government housing or out of their government jobs.
Well, here in Santa Cruz, we're going to be building 10,000 housing units, mostly very proximate to the beach. These will be government-controlled units that are allocated out by the Santa Cruz County Housing Authority. Now, this is an agency with 32,000 square feet of office space, and they plan to do some big business. Well, you know, if you don't do it their way, they pick and choose who lives in these giveaway houses.
That's
at the rest
right.
of America's expense. And this is the big trend here in California, and it's something that the governor's office is full bore behind, and as they work under something called the California Performance Review, to, in or Arnold Schwarzenegger's words, to create the first 21st century government in the United States. Well, that's a government that is predicated upon these granted, or what are you using, Marco?
Usufruct, or usufructory.
Okay, based on that rights system. And so California is in very fast transition, and the rest of America ought to take note of that, and ought to take note of the advanced stage that we have entered into in this state in terms of marrying the wildland project. Boy, the rural landowners are in horrible shape in this state.
Right.
With the smart growth dynamic, which is reshaping and will have dramatic effects, I suspect, over fairly short period of time, wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. What we're seeing happening is using the Soviet model to allocate out the right housing and so forth. And boy, once you're into that system, you are basically controlled by the government, because if you get out of line, you have deep trouble for your family, because you'll be out in the street. And that's exactly what the Soviets did, and it's going to be what the government does to those government housing units there in your particular area before very long. It won't start that way, but it won't be very long before it gravitates that direction.
No, I mean, it's not going to be tomorrow, but it is going to be, I think, within the lifetime of the baby boomer. And so the massive cost in financial contraction, lifestyle contraction that comes along with a government-private partnership economy, a Soviet government system, is going to be very dramatic, and it's not something we can just shuffle off to our children, as horrible enough as that is.
That's very true. The second side of this whole issue of property rights was just rediscovered, because our founders talked about it extensively, and that is that the right to use your property in the way that you best see fit, other than those ways that harm your neighbor or cause a serious nuisance, health hazard, whatever the case is. Those have always been excluded since the times of the Magna Carta.
And so we're not arguing against certain regulated activities, are we?
No, not at all. And those are very definitely necessary. What I'm talking about is the arbitrary types of regulations that come with smart growth, comes with this wildlands project and so forth, where the government basically has the right to tell you what you can and cannot do that otherwise would be perfectly allowable and not cause any harm to anyone else. It's purely a subjective way of regulating your existence. That then has a huge impact then on the wealth of your community, of you personally, and of the entire nation. What was just discovered by the World Bank a couple of years ago was that the poor nations of the world have not profited from capitalism, primarily because the people were never granted legal property rights, so that they had asset value that they could then use to build businesses and so forth, as we're able to do or have been able to do here in the United States. And what is happening through all these regulations, and there's a direct correlation, a real close correlation between the amount of regulations and the general wealth of the community or the nation itself around the world. The more freedom you have in the use of private property rights, excluding those things that cause harm, nuisance, health hazards, and so forth, is the more regulations you have, the poorer the nation. It's almost a one-to-one relationship.
Well, but, people have given consideration to political economics have known that for a long time. Now, that may not be the thrust of our educational system, and so it may be that many people who would readily understand that are currently confused somewhat. But what strikes me about sustainable development is that the people really behind this understand what you just said, but what strikes me is that it appears that the people behind the sustainable development movement, and there's always people behind a movement, seem to have evidenced their desire that the middle class be eliminated, because it's hard to control human beings as biological resources if there's a middle class.
That's right.
A self-sufficient middle class. And in fact, I always like to remind listeners of what was said when the Biodiversity Treaty and the Rio Accords were announced to the world back in 1992, when the leader of the UN conference, a man named Maurice Strong, said, "Current lifestyles and consumption patterns of the affluent middle class involving meat intake, use of fossil fuels, appliances, home and work air conditioning, and suburban housing are not sustainable. We'll be right back. We're back at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and I'm here with Dr. Michael Kaufman discussing sustainable development, where it came from, and what it's doing in the land use element, that is the Wildlands Project to take control of America's rural lands and natural resources, and the Smart Growth Movement, which is now beginning to knock on the doors of cities and suburban areas. We're finding our transportation systems are becoming more difficult and more expensive. We're finding our housing options are being limited as circles are drawn around cities upon which you cannot build outside, forcing up prices so high that it's becoming more and more difficult to enter a housing market if you're a young person. And all other kinds of aspects of increasing regulation and control. In one of the towns in our county here, you cannot cut a tree in your yard, in your suburban lot, if a neighbor has his designs on that tree and has registered that tree as a tree of interest. If you do so, if you cut it down, prune it, or plant under it without an environmental review conducted by the city staff or their friends, you're subject to a $15,000 fine. Now, ordinances like that are spreading like crazy across the country in towns everywhere. How is it, Michael, this happens? You got this crazy idea called sustainable development. How does it get to take its root inside your small town city council?
Well, it's a very interesting phenomenon because the whole concept of sustainable development has come out of the United Nations and an organization called the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. In fact, it was the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, that first proposed it, and it was picked up then by the United Nations. At the time, the Marie Strong, who was the Secretary General of the Earth Summit in 1992 at Rio de Janeiro that you just quoted before the last break, was one of the directors of the IUCN. And what he basically did is the IUCN is made up of several hundred different governmental agencies, including the EPA, the National Parks, the United States National Park Service, the U.S. Forest Service, the Oceanographic, I can't think of the name. But anyway, any of the land management agencies, federal agencies, belong to the IUCN. And he opened it up for membership by non-governmental organizations like the Sierra Club, Nature Conservancy, and many, many hundreds, actually thousands of others. And now it's made up of all these green organizations and represented by basically green federal agencies who then conspire, and this was actually in the 1996 webpage, to basically put out an eco-spiritual agenda. That's the words they used.
The words they used were eco-spiritual.
Eco-spiritual agenda in order to preserve Mother Nature. And that takes the form then of all of these international treaties like the Convention on Biological Diversity, the Convention on Desertification, the Convention on Alien Species, the Convention on Climate Change, and you can name them, and it goes on ad nauseum. And what it does...
So they're all related together.
All related together.
Ideas came out of the
treaties.
Same pot.
Right.
Who have already expressed a desire for an eco-spirituality.
That's right.
Wow.
And any one of those treaties by themselves won't destroy you, but all of them together basically put all of the control of everything you do, the air that you breathe, what you do about going to work and so forth, turn it basically over to the international community directed by the United Nations.
Wow.
It is a powerful, powerful thing that we need to recognize that we're incrementally being taken over by the international community.
Hold that thought. Well, welcome back to our listeners who have been on station break. I'm here with Dr. Michael Kaufman, and we're discussing the massive connections between the federal government and the United Nations in terms of instituting a number of treaties that were classified as a package and labeled eco-spirituality and a need for us to, rebirth ourselves into this pagan idea while we tax ourselves and steal from ourselves American assets from American people. putting it into government control or the partners of government's control as our rural landowners continue to feel great pain. Farmers having their water stolen in this valley, forest owners having their trees stolen in these mountains, and fishermen not being able to fish on the seas right off the Santa Cruz coast. This is happening everywhere, and until people realize that there is a pattern going on through Washington and into our state and into our communities, we're going to be somewhat set up, aren't we?
Yes, we are. It is by design. If you consider the Wildlands Project as setting aside as much as half of the United States into wilderness areas, and then surrounding those wilderness areas are going to be buffer zones that to protect the attributes of the wilderness areas, and those buffer zones gradually go into your urban areas. Now, when you imagine your urban areas with your urban growth boundaries, you can't build outside of that urban growth boundary. That boundary starts then the buffer zone for the wilderness areas that they are going to be gradually implementing over the next 100 years.
Well, let's get back to this for a second, the wilderness area. What does that mean? I mean, everybody wants to go hiking in wilderness, you know. Hunters like to go hunting in wilderness, and foresters like to go into the wilderness and manage the forest so that it's more productive and more diverse, richer, and a more wonderful place. Isn't that what wilderness means?
No, wilderness does not mean that. Wilderness, according to them, is an area that human beings cannot go into and cause disturbance of any kind, other than maybe taking a day pack trip or something into it and then returning at night.
So who would benefit from that? I mean, that's
only
a notion.
The very wealthy would benefit from it. From the rest of us, we're going to, first of all, we're not going to even have any automobiles if they had their ways, because we'd live within walking distance of the places we'd work.
Now, that's called a livable or walkable city, isn't it, in the smart growth lingo? Okay.
That's right. And so unless you're part of the 5 or 8% that is wealthy, the rest of us are going to be basically in the poverty level. And I'm saying that kind of tongue-in-cheek, but not really, because you look back at all of the major empires and so forth of history, and what you find is always a two-class system when you have this kind of approach. You have the very poor and the very rich, because the middle class, as you just said a few minutes ago, is eliminated, and that's what's happening.
Well, it shouldn't take too long for most adult Americans to think back on America and what made it different. Well, it starts by being different in that from its inception, the landscape was owned by citizens, and it could be sold by that citizen to any other citizen who wanted to buy it. It was a open and free landscape that allowed people to go in and do what was best to serve and the interests of other people by creating a society that improved. It was a society that was open for improvement. But if you take away those rural lands and you take away those natural resources from the control of the citizens and put it into the hands of an oligarchy, you're going to end up with a caste system.
Yep. And that's the history that we, the lesson we learned from history is exactly what you say, and yet we're plummeting towards that very thing right now. I mean, the acceleration by which we're moving towards that is just blinding.
Well, you know, Ayn Rand used the term when she was alive, could see this coming, and she would say it was the sanction of the victim. In other words, here we are being a victim and approving of it. You know, we're taxing ourselves to accelerate this downfall. We're stealing. We're not respecting our neighbors. We're stealing from our neighbors. We're putting ropes around ourselves with urban growth boundaries. And then we're making ourselves subject to more and more rules and less options.
And every time we do that, we take another chunk out of our economy, because no longer can we be creative. We're basically, we have to do what the planners tell us to do. We can't create a new product. We can't innovate. And therefore, we begin to go downhill on the economic ladder.
Well, you know, though, we've got all those multinational corporations that are part of this sustainable development movement, or not all of them, but some of them certainly are. Certainly they can take care of us, and we can all just live as dependents off the state and maybe live along the beach somewhere, and all our cares be taken care of for us, so long as we don't question anybody or do anything we're not supposed to do and never learn too much. Could that be a
well, they're not going to be around much longer either. And I finally figured out why, what's happening at the international level with those international or multinational corporations.
Well, when we get back from a couple-minute break, we're going to hear all about that. And thank you for joining us tonight at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show.
Are your public officials or the people on their staff talking about sustainable development plans for your town or neighborhood? Are you sure they know what they're talking about? Public officials have heard good things about Smart Growth, the Wildlands Project, and sustainable development in general. But few really understand what they are. Now, thanks to the efforts of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, there is an easy way to teach your public officials about sustainable development. We have developed a document entitled Understanding Sustainable Development Agenda 21, a guide for public officials. Simply download the guide for public officials from our website at freedom21santacruz.net and give it to your representatives to help them learn more about sustainable development. When you go to freedom21santacruz.net, that website, once again, is freedom21santacruz.net. If you would like book copies, please call us for special pricing. The phone number is 831-684-2232.
You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right, Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic.
To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
As a listener of tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, you have exclusive access to our online audience participation center at freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Here are just some of the value-added features you'll get by logging on while you're tuned in. Get free access to the research and articles that have contributed to tonight's show. See an important multimedia presentation, Tyranny. So get more. Log on while you're tuned in and advance freedom at freedom21santacruz.net/radio.
Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm here tonight with Dr. Michael Kaufman, and we have been discussing the sustainable development land use element that has swept the country under the guidance of the federal government. And we're about now to talk about multinational corporate involvement in the sustainable development movement. Proceed from there, Michael.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting thing. We've been all witnessing major protests at some of the World Bank meetings, the IMF meetings, these are various economic international meetings. Now, for the last about 4 years, starting in 1999 at the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle, and what we're seeing here are people who are coming from different parts of the world who are not benefiting from this global economic trade that's been going on. And the reason why, and this is so stunning that it is absolutely blinding, and if you haven't read a book by Joseph Stiglitz, you really should read it, because it does help explain this. He doesn't understand the full picture because he didn't put the other half of the puzzle together. Well, what he's basically saying is that because we have no legal infrastructure for private property rights in these third world nations, do not have access to the equity, and there's about $9.3 trillion worth of equity, that's more than all the stock markets in the world, that are available to these poor people in these nations, but they have no access to it because they have no legal structure for their private property rights. And as a consequence, they can't borrow against their house. Even though it has equity value, they cannot borrow against it to start a business or to expand a business or to invest in another business or whatever the case is, like you and I can. And so a multinational corporation comes into these poor nations. They create a manufacturing facility of some sort. They buy their property rights because they can pay off the government officials and so forth. Corruption is rampant. And they can establish this, pay pennies on the dollar for labor, and put out a cheaper product than we can put out here in the United States, and therefore we lose our my mind is blank, but we're losing jobs to overseas because of this phenomenon. If those people in those nations had access to their asset values, they can do just like we do and invest in that business and keep their money in that their own nation, build up their own wealth, begin to start producing. Their wages would go up and it would no longer be competitive for our multinational corporations to move offshore, and therefore we would be able to start selling them materials and everybody would benefit. But because of greed, and that's what it boils down to, what we've established is a brand new form of imperialism, not unlike what we saw 100 to 200 years ago with Great Britain and so forth, where we are suppressing the rights of these other people and actually benefiting at their expense. And sooner or later, the whole thing has got to come collapsing down because we are rapidly losing our ability to buy the products from these multinational corporations, and eventually they're going to go under too.
Well, how does this relate to sustainable development?
Because, again, the other side of the picture is we're not allowing them to build up their wealth in these third world nations. At the same time, we're imposing the regulatory structure for sustainable development on U.S. citizens, and we are stealing the wealth from us, and eventually we will become a third world nation.
Well, isn't there some consistent dynamic in the whole rights analysis? America, through American multinational corporations, you're telling us, is in the third world countries where perhaps the United States foreign policy has worked to create a democracy, but a democracy that is not based on natural or unalienable rights.
Yeah.
And so we're participating in the subjugation of these peoples when we are supporting governments and that do not recognize the unalienable rights of each and every citizen. So what we're really doing is we're seeing the foundation for a non-middle class world around the world being established through a lack of rights that's being serviced by multinational corporations. At the same time, we see the nature of our natural rights being eroded through a justice system here in the United States, and it's all falling into place toward a lower common denominator. Would that be
That's a very accurate statement. I really, truly am very concerned about what's happening into the ability for us to survive as the wealthiest nation in the world. We're rapidly being disassembled. We don't know it. We're hearing the labor unions cry because their jobs are going overseas, and we need to, that's the bellwether. We need to be aware of what's happening there. It's not by accident. It's happening deliberately, and because of that, we are rapidly losing our middle class.
Well, Michael, we've got 15 or a few more minutes than that left in this hour. An American right now might be inclined to want to turn off the radio and say, well, I can't to bring myself to think about that. You know, you're telling us that the federal government and some sort of global machine, political economic machinery that includes multinational corporations, and we could offer that it also includes certain American aristocratic foundations. You know, what are we to do? We're overwhelmed. I mean, what is it that each person who understands this, what is it that needs to happen?
It's one of those things where I think together it's a house of cards. It's what they have built. And once it's exposed, it's going to come crashing down. And I was greatly rewarded by this November's elections, because what I saw is the so-called phantom moral majority finally came out to vote. Now, that doesn't solve the problem. We have other problems. But we need to recognize that we have to hold our politicians accountable, both at the local level, the state level, and the United States level, Congress, and so forth. We have an opportunity that we have not had in probably 40 to 50 years to begin to turn the tide against what these planners, this is what I will call them, for lack of a better word, these planners are trying to design the world to do to suit themselves, not realizing that they're destroying the very fabric that makes wealth a possibility, and at the same time, wealth is necessary to protect the environment. We don't want to go off and just create a bunch of manufacturers that belch out smoke and kill forests and so forth. We have to have wealth in order to protect our environment, and we're killing the goose that laid the golden egg, as it were, and all of these environmental, regulatory, smart growth, and so forth regulations, and we need to begin to stop it. And there's been a number, the thing that excites me the most, Oregon is probably the number one state that smart growth has been implemented the longest, and is causing economic havoc in the state. And surprisingly enough, the voters on November 2nd voted by a 60% margin what was called Proposition 37, or it was a slightly different name, but it was 37, which basically guarantees just compensation when a regulation that does not have anything to do with harm or nuisance or health risk or anything else, when a regulation is passed for a purely arbitrary purpose of some planner's dream, when that happens, as has happened tremendously in Oregon, the property owner is guaranteed just compensation, and that's going to put the brake and it's going to come to a screeching halt in, I think, Oregon over the next several years, as finally the citizens of Portland and some of the larger cities along the Willamette Valley there begin to see how much all of this smart growth and regulation is really costing, because up until now it's been the property owners that have been carrying the weight of that economic cost by have been denied their highest and best use of their land. And now it's going to have to be the taxpayer that picks up the difference, and they're going to see for the very first time the huge cost of all of these regulations.
Well, I think there's a number of positive signs out there, because as people understand sustainable development, they can begin to evaluate the silliness that's played out between the Democrat and the Republican parties, and how both of them take a step on a ladder toward the advancement of sustainable development. So once we begin to understand that simple term, it is, like you say, a house of cards. You build it from the bottom. It's got to start with your school boards and your fire boards and your water boards and your city councils and your county supervisors. Boy, that's the important place. You know, it's restoring your county, because all these programs, one way or another, are funded or directed by the federal government.
That's right. And interestingly enough, we have a program, and it's been struggling to get off ground, called LEARN. And that particular process does exactly that. It helps local citizens enable their local government to be able to use existing law, usually federal law, to put the brakes on a lot of this excessive types of applications of regulations. And it's worked very well. But you have to have a city council or a county set of county commissioners and so forth that are willing to defend the rights of its citizens rather than bend their knees to the federal government.
Well, that's true, and in many counties along the Pacific Coast, that's not going to happen until the citizens begin to understand that their rights are in jeopardy as soon as they stop respecting the equal rights to the neighbors' use of their own property.
And, that's right.
And, of course, it kind of started on the coast, where in some of these beautiful areas, people got into a town and they said, oh, we're going to restrict anybody's ability to build on lands or put a tight nucleus on where we'll draw an urban growth boundary. And now the price is being paid by the people who supported that in the first instance, because they can't, their children can't buy a house, and their infrastructure has been inadequately developed over all these years, and strife builds, and property tax pressures are going to begin to build over this next decade, and we've just dug ourselves a deep hole from which we need to extract ourselves, and the way
That's
we
right.
start doing that is to respect each other's equal rights.
That's right.
Through life, liberty, and property. You can.
It's fascinating. Harvard University did a study a couple of years ago looking at this very issue of these urban growth boundaries. And what they found is that those major cities like Baltimore, Kansas City, and Cincinnati, and so forth, Houston, that have minimal zoning laws. In other words, these are the zoning laws that are designed to protect the rights of property owners in their cities. You don't build a factory right next to a subdivision type of thing. Those laws have been in effect now for well over 100 years, and they work very well. Certainly, they're not perfect, but they work well. And what they did is compare them to cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles and Anaheim and Seattle and so forth that are implementing this smart growth phenomenon. And what they have found is that the average cost per quarter acre lot in those cities that have not implemented smart growth is about $30,000, or roughly $100,000 per a lot within those major cities. If you get to the cities that have smart growth, the lowest that you find is $200,000 a quarter lot, or $800,000 for an acre, all the way up to $600,000 for a quarter lot in San Francisco, all directly related to smart growth.
Well, you know, as Ludwig von Mises said, interference by the agent of force leads to harm, now, later, to you or someone else. We have a caller, Michael Bob from Santa Cruz. Bob, are you with us?
Yeah, how you doing?
Good. What's your question tonight?
Well, you know, increased productivity is part of the times. I'm going to read a sentence, if I might, from Barron's, November 8th. It's about U.S. Steel. One sentence, reflecting vastly increased productivity and automation, the company will make about the same amount of steel this year as it did in 1979, but with about 75% fewer workers. Now, whose fault is that?
Oh, I don't think that's a fault. I think that's a sign of progress. And if we respected, if we had systems of government and of economics and of justice that supported the idea that each person has a right to their own life and decide the terms of that life, if that were the case, that kind of productivity would simply result in rising living standards and shortened work weeks. But it is the burden that comes with the interference that keeps being jabbed at us by one government or another government that causes us to go upside down as time passes along. And so, you know, I think there's nothing but credit given to the productive people that bring about the kinds of improvements that lead to the statistic you just mentioned. Well, thank you very much, Bob, for your call. Michael, what are your thoughts about the forest issues, the fires here out west, and you know, back to the wildlands concept? Does the Sustainable Development Program have something to do with these?
That is really, as far as rural America is concerned, that is the heart of the Sustainable Development concept, is allowing nature to basically take its natural course. I have a PhD in ecosystems analysis. That's my really strong forte. And as a consequence, I understand. I've taken fire. I've been involved in fire ecology as well as a variety of different things like that. And the whole concept of sustainable development from A to Z, from planning in urban areas to the planning in the wildlands areas, is diametrically opposed to reality. And this is what scares me to death, is you've got these dreamers sitting in the 12th floor or the 50th floor of some high-rise someplace in the world, creating these divisions of what they would like to see without any concept of what it takes to create it or to maintain the world or biodiversity, whatever that is you want to look at. And biodiversity is maximized with good forest management. And I want to say that again. Biodiversity is maximized with good forest management. It is minimized when nature takes its natural course. And what you're seeing happening in the western forest is about 30 years of no management on our national forest systems because of all the environmental pressure and so forth that have been brought by these non-governmental organizations that are members of the IUCN, along with the U.S. Forest Service, which is also members of the IUCN, basically shutting down our forest products industry and therefore preventing the very thing that we need to do to maximize biological diversity. And nature is taking its course, and we're seeing the results of that right now.
And would you say that 4 years of the Bush administration has served the forest to reverse this trend?
It's beginning to reverse it. I'm kind of interested to see. You know, there's a lot of things that President Bush has done that I don't particularly like. But there's a number of things that he has done. And the forest health bill that he passed a couple of years ago is going to be, I think, a major help in this process of beginning to clean out some of our forests and beginning to increase the species diversity and so forth. Because species diversity...
Hold this thought for a minute, Michael.
At the dawn of the 21st century, America is at a crossroads. The path we choose will have far-reaching effects on our lives and on the lives of the generations to come. America's choice is simple. Liberty or sustainable development? Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, in conjunction with the American Policy Center, has developed a way for you to learn more about sustainable development. America's Choice, Liberty or Sustainable Development, is the title of this info-packed set of three DVDs. During over 6 hours of intriguing presentations, you will hear from America's foremost experts on sustainable development. You will hear Michael Shaw speak on liberty and life of one's own. You will hear from Dr. Michael Kaufman as he lays out the fraud of smart growth. You will hear from Michael Chapman, who documents transformational education and how it's preparing our children for global citizenship. You will hear from Beverly Eckman, and she exposes the poop manipulation tactics used by sustainable developers. And you will learn from Tom DeWeese about how sustainable development is bringing about a raging transformation of America. Get this special package today for only $49. Pick up the phone and call us to place your order. The number is 831-684-2232. Or visit our safe and secure website at freedom21santacruz.net to place your online order now. Choose wisely, whether America's choice, liberty, or sustainable development today. That website, once again, is freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Well, welcome back. I'm Michael Shaw. I'm here with Michael Kaufman. We've been talking about sustainable development and its land use element, smart growth, and the Wildlands Project. And before we broke off there, Michael, you credited the Bush administration for perhaps bringing some improvement to this dynamic with the Healthy Forest Act. And I just got to make one comment there. It may or may not end up in the reduction of fuel load, but it does nothing to support the idea of private property and individual liberty when it comes to the management decisions with regard to private property, because many of these western forests have been on private land that have not been able to be managed. And what that act does is legislates that now you're in partnership with the federal government, and now that you're a partner, we'll let you thin your forest maybe a little bit. And I was not impressed with that legislation for that reason.
Well, and you got a good point. It was not the best legislation. I would have liked to have seen something different. I think it was a start, though, and I'm holding back just a little bit to see what he does in the second term, because he's talked up this concept of private property rights several times in the last couple of months, and It got him elected, and if he continues to actually implement what he's been speaking, both in the judicial area and appointing judges, as well as some of the laws that he's going to propose over the next several years, we can begin to cut back on some of the advances that have been made by government, especially the federal government, encroaching upon private property rights, because we have to do that. The survival of the United States, as we've known it, it depends on it.
Well, it certainly does, but as we're going to discuss in the second hour, there's a dialectic, that is, two sides of the same coin marching together here, and so I think sometimes one can put on the front that they're moving backwards, but they're still holding to the same premise. They're still holding to that premise of granted rights rather than unalienable rights, and until that reflection comes out of Washington, D.C., we're just playing a game of moving chairs around, and that's why it's so important that this rights analysis and how sustainable development reflects a rights analysis that turns human beings into chattel needs to be spread out.
Yes, it does, Michael. You couldn't have said it better. And that's our number one priority. And I agree that we maybe not see nothing more than the dialectic of the same side, or two sides of the same coin. If that's the case, then we have a much bigger problem. I'm hoping that it's not, and we'll have to see what happens over the next year or so.
Well, you know, it's a wholesale rejection of we have the federal government. We have about four or five departments of the federal government in this county, and their actions and their federal dollars, to extort the local officials into doing it the smart growth way are astronomical.
Yeah.
I mean, amazing dollars, whether it's for water programs, education programs, housing programs, rail programs, conservation easement programs. It's everywhere.
It is everywhere. And money talks.
Yeah,
and the whole concept of control by taking federal dollars is something that we need to be very, very concerned about.
Well, you know, it's just time that some more Americans, I mean, some of the brilliant quotes from founding fathers just never lose the ring. And one that comes to mind to me right now is one from George Washington, who said, "Few men have virtue to withstand the highest bidder." Well, those few men need to stand up and show their neighbors that they understand this and become elected to office. And because we need those few men who have that virtue so that they can withstand the selling out of America's future and our children's future.
Absolutely. And as you said before, it starts at the local level.
And what we need to do there, I hear some folks, people around the country, sometimes they say, "Well, we don't want to talk about sustainable development. You know, we're a tax, we fight on unreasonable taxes." And I just say, well, you got to understand that the tax programs you're fighting are sustainable development programs. And when you cut off a sustainable development program, it sprouts three new weeds. It's amazing how that works. You know, if you defeat them, but you just defeat them on a specific issue. Now, if you can defeat them because the public has begun to understand that you've got policies that are being implemented that are in their worst interest, then I think we'll see sustainable development start to contract.
Yes. Until that time, it's just going to be one battle at a time, and we're going to lose one battle at a time.
Well, we're going to win the rights analysis, and that's going to win the day for us. And I want to thank you so much. It's late back east for this show, and but we encourage that Eastern audience to just keep listening and spread the word out there about sustainable.
views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Are you? Welcome to tonight's edition of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm Michael Shaw, and we're here tonight to talk about how plants and animals are being used to eliminate private property and subvert liberty. Former Department of Interior official Jim Beers reports on how the Endangered Species Act is being used to grow federal power and subvert state authority at the expense of federalism and private property. Learn how state universities' natural resource departments have been transformed into agents of the sustainable New World Order propaganda. Hear about what this transformation will mean for you, your children, and freedom in America. Our guest tonight is Jim Beers, who's a retired United States Fish and Wildlife Service wildlife biologist. He's been a special agent and a refuge manager. He was stationed in North Dakota, Minnesota, Nebraska, New York City, and Washington, D.C. In the 1990s, while in Washington, Jim worked to prevent the European Union from banning the importation of furs. The administration publicly supported Jim's efforts to protect trapping, but worked privately with environmental and animal rights groups to support the European ban. In the course of all this, Jim became aware of the pilferage of millions of dollars from state fish and wildlife excise taxes by United States Fish and Wildlife Service managers. He testified before Congress about the misuse of funds, and a GAO, or Government Accounting Office, audit verified that $45 to $60 million had been taken in a two-year period. Jim, though, was forced out of government service. Later, he received a cash settlement due to the retaliatory actions that had been taken against him. Today, Jim speaks and writes about wildlife, animal rights, environmental, and government issues. He tries to explain and expose the chicanery, whether it's from the environmentalists or animal right radicals, government bureaucrats, university so-called experts, or the conservation organizations. So we're going to look forward to having our special guest, Mr. Beers, with us, although I'm being informed by our production manager that we're having some telephone difficulties in getting Jim on the line. So while that's worked out, we'll discuss a little bit more in general terms about the Endangered Species Act and its soon-to-be-birthed offspring, the Invasive Species Act, as sort of a prelude to what it is that Mr. Beers is going to be able to fill us in respect to those and other subjects. Most of America is becoming increasingly aware that the Endangered Species Act is being used as a tool to take private property and the citizens' general ability to use and enjoy the natural environment that exists throughout the United States. Repeatedly, trails are being opened, uses being cut off to various types of recreational uses, and of course our natural resource base, whether it be the production of timber or minerals or farmlands even, are under increasing pressure from the application of increasingly nonsensical applications of an act passed 30 years ago, which has grown out of proportion. We'll be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station, and hopefully with our guest, Mr. Beers.
You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right, Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic.
To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232. Policies, procedures, and laws enacted by local government and non-government organizations in the name of diversity, community, and Earth are diminishing individual liberty, degrading ecology, and threatening human life and happiness in towns across the nation. You've likely already experienced some of the consequences of policies that are approaching full implementation, with little public discourse or voter input. Have you experienced any of the following? Restricted freedom of mobility as you sit for hours in gridlock traffic. Mounting limitations on, or even loss of, your private property. An engineered housing crisis that you're being told must be solved with your money by those who caused it. Loss of parental authority to a government education system that seems to emphasize social indoctrination over education. Transitioning of water resources to regional control by non-elected bureaucrats with subsequent engineered shortages. Heavy influence of international and non-government organizations over local policy at the expense of representative democracy. You're not alone in recognizing these and other symptoms of our diminishing freedoms. The adverse consequences of collectivist policies and laws enacted by local government bodies are affecting almost every citizen in your town. Many have noticed and are ready to act to advance individual liberty, family autonomy, a vibrant ecology, and a strong economy. They're doing this by turning their individual initiative into local action for national impact. To find out how you can join others to advance freedom, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232. That's freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Well, welcome to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. We have a first here tonight. We're having some severe difficulty in reaching Mr. Beers. And that's quite unfortunate. We'll continue to try, and if in the interim we have callers out there who have some general issues or questions that they want to raise, our scheduled program tonight was on the Endangered Species Act and how plants and animals are being used to destroy liberty in America. But if you've got some other issues or some questions about Freedom 21, now would be a fine time to raise them. And while we move along, let me point out the guide that has been developed at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz called Understanding Sustainable Development Agenda 21. You know, it's so often that you find public officials either innocently or not so innocently arguing that Agenda 21 is nothing more than a conspiracy theory. Well, you know, the change agents in our states and in our towns try to deny its existence, but its existence is real. There's nothing conspiratorial, and there is nothing theoretical about the reality of Agenda 21. In fact, as we reported today in our periodic report and on our advanced bulletin website, the United States 2002 report to the United Nations summarizes, in the government's own words, what action the U.S. has taken in order to attain the ominous objectives of Global Agenda 21. And this is a report given to the masters at the United Nations, a very detailed report. And if you go to freedom21santacruz.net and go to the advanced bulletin, the top story is a summary of this with the complete document linked. So you can look yourself and for yourself and provide that information to anyone who's questioning the existence of Agenda 21 and whether or not it is affecting our lives, because certainly it is. And if you want a nice, neat summary of what Agenda 21 is, the pamphlet that we've published called Understanding Sustainable Development Agenda 21, A Guide for Public Officials, will provide you that information as well as your neighbors and public officials, friends, and family members. Because there's no one who can read that who, even if they choose to deny the facts that are stated there, over a period of time, it begins to sink in, and they begin to see all around them the evidence of the fast-approaching policies of Agenda 21. So, let me... how are we doing there, Charlie? We're trying to reach Jim Beers. Looks like we're not doing real well. Well, the United States is now, Congress is now taking a look at the Endangered Species Act. There's increasing analysis and speculation that the act may be reauthorized and modified in some ways. Hearings are being held before Congressman Pombo for the purposes of doing that. And the unfortunate part about all that is that the act is reauthorized would probably be worse than the act that exists now, even though it's being advertised as one that's friendly to property owners. And we're going to hear more about that because we do have Mr. Beers on the phone line now. Jim, are you there?
I sure am.
Well,
I apologize
for
the delay here.
Well, I'm awfully happy to hear your voice.
Okay.
Well, we've given the audience an introduction to what our subject is and to who you are. And included in that was your experiences with the trapping dynamic, the European ban, and the consequence that befell you and with respect to the government and the consequences that befell the government as a result of their retaliatory actions against you. But since then, I understand you've been, and I know for a fact that you've been around the country spreading the word about what kind of chicanery is going on with the Endangered Species Act and the environmental policies generally with the government. So with that, why don't you start in and fill our audience in with some information?
Well, I've in the last 5 or 6 years since I retired from the government, tried to do all I can to explain to people the connection with the UN and the way the Endangered Species Act is changing our government in general, as well as doing a lot of environmental harm, and the way the agencies have used it for purposes that no one really imagined. And I guess the best place to start is to tell you that an act like the Endangered Species Act could not just be passed by Congress and give the federal government jurisdiction over any plant or animal species or subspecies or race or population that they want to have jurisdiction over. Because the Constitution placed all of the plants and animals under the state governments. So up till the 1960s, with one exception that I could explain in a minute, the state governments are the ones who are the authorities over plants and animals in the United States. The federal government was limited by the Constitution to controlling the importation and interstate movement of plants and animals. And there's one other exception, I guess. You could say that in 1917, the federal government signed a treaty with Canada for some migratory bird species to protect them. And these are birds that generally migrated back and forth between the two countries, everything from cardinals and robins to ducks and geese. And when the federal government signed that treaty, under our Constitution, that treaty supersedes the Constitution itself. So when the United States government signs a treaty that the president signs and the Senate ratifies, that then becomes the law of the land in spite of anything said in the Constitution.
Well, Jim, excuse me for a minute just to break in on that. I think there's some dispute about that. Certainly if a treaty were signed or ratified by 100 men in the U.S. Congress that negated all clauses existent in the U.S. Constitution, you'd have to read the provision that treaty power is the law of the land in the context of the whole document. And I think there are writers and thinkers, and the issue really hasn't been raised yet directly, who would argue that there is authority and that there is the meaning that stands behind the Constitution that would say, sure, it is the law of the land, but not if it's in clear, obvious, and in such an important way, contrary to all the purposes that are otherwise for which the Declaration of Independence was signed and the war was fought. And it does strike me that the Endangered Species Act is moving into that territory as its interpretation has been expanded so broadly just in the last 10 years from an act that was signed 30 years ago. So I wonder about the premise of just accepting the fact that anything Congress does now pursuant to the Endangered Species Act, since it was originally ratified by treaty, is suddenly a valid law.
Well, you're exactly right from a common sense point of view. But the Constitution does say that a treaty becomes the law of the land. And that, up for the last couple of hundred years, has been a fairly simple and straightforward matter for us. In other words, if we signed a disarmament treaty or some treaty with a foreign power that we would do certain things and they would do certain things, if they didn't live up to their end of it, we could break the treaty. But the full force of the government, it was put behind honoring the treaty as the Constitution calls for. And what we've seen has happened in the last 30 years, and is still happening, and in fact, it's planned that it happen in even more ways, is that the UN, United Nations, brings up a topic, an international topic that we should all be concerned about. Today it's global warming, and it's invasive species and native ecosystems and small arms. But 35 years ago, it was endangered species. There were species disappearing around the world, and the UN was going to do something about it. And what the UN does when it does something about something is they propose a convention. And a convention is a kind of a quasi-treaty that a lot of countries, in the case of the Endangered Species Act, it enforces the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, called CITES, C-I-T-E-S. And the United States signed that because everybody here was all in a dither about saving the world species, elephants and eagles and that. And the courts of the United States have ruled that a convention through the UN is the same as a treaty. Well, a treaty, if we have a treaty, say, with Russia, that we're going to disarm and they're going to disarm and we're going to do this and they're going to do that, if they don't live up to their end of it, we could break that treaty. But a convention through the United Nations is kind of a brokered agreement. Zimbabwe may not go along with it. China may not go along with this part of it. European nations may not go along with that part of it. But it's still there. It's always in place. And what happens is the United States passes enabling legislation for the treaty. They call it enabling legislation. In other words, to use our simple example earlier, if we signed a disarmament treaty with Russia, we would issue some, Congress would pass some acts and issue regulations here that would make the government and everybody do the things called for in the treaty. Well, the Endangered Species Act was the enabling legislation that was written up by our bureaucrats here in the United States, and strangely enough, I was working in Washington then. The bureaucrats here in the United States that wrote up and drafted the Endangered Species Act for Congress and then wrote the regulations had worked a couple years earlier with the UN bureaucrats to get the CITES documents passed. So they were all cut from the same bolt of cloth, and those regulations began to include subspecies, races and populations, and say that private property wasn't inviolate for the case of this endangered species. Jack?
Hold that thought, Jim. Okay. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station. While some of our affiliates take an advertising break, we'll continue with our special guest, Jim Species, Jim Beers, talking about species. And let's proceed with that talk.
Okay. What, in addition to saying that private property wasn't inviolate, for instance, the federal government could say, why, on Jim Beers' ranch over here, the habitat in those trees is important to the willow flycatcher, and we've declared that endangered, so Jim Beers, you can't cut any of those trees or do anything with those trees from now on because that's critical habitat. I turn around and say, well, look, if you're going to call that critical habitat, you better pay me for my property here. Oh, no, you know, we don't have to do that. So they established this very un-American principle that they could trample over property owners. At the same time, they said to the state government, we're going to list the sage-grouse as endangered. And the state government might say, well, hold it, we hunt the sage-grouse here. That's important to us, and that's too bad. The federal government has decided that this is going to be an endangered species, and that's now under our jurisdiction. And then within about 10 years, they went so far as to say, well, the federal government has decided that you should have wolves once again. And the farmers and the ranchers said, holy cow, they're going to kill our livestock. They're going to cause us all kinds of problems. The pet owners say, they're going to kill my pets. And a lot of people said, gosh, wolves are going to be a threat to my children when they go to the bus stop in winter. That's too bad. The federal government's employing the Endangered Species Act here, and you have to go along with this, and if the wolves kill your cattle, that's too bad. That's not the federal government's responsibility. If they annihilate most of the elk herd and the moose herd so that there's no hunting allowed anymore, that's too bad. So the thing is sort of just like a snowball getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's caused all kinds of other problems. For instance, state universities, up till the 1970s when this act was passed, were very much oriented to educating and turning out forest managers, foresters, and wildlife managers, and fishery managers, and grazing managers, people who understood grass and trees and wildlife and plants and fish, and knew how to manage them so that every year you could take so many of them out, whether it was for commercial fishing purposes or for lumber purposes or to grow cattle and sheep or to have hunting seasons and generate all this money and use year in and year out sustainably. They no longer do that because the federal government has changed the orientation in the United States from one of managing these natural resources to one of protecting and saving everything. That's what's behind the business about closing roads into the wilderness. That's what's behind closing down horseback riding in this area. That's what's behind closing down grazing allotments over here. And when you step back and look at that, all of these actions by the federal government, behind it, you see the new radical organizations in the environmental and animal rights movement, the Humane Society of the United States, the Wilderness Society, the Sierra Club, are very much the people who work with the federal government today and go with them into court.
Sorry about that, Jim. Our audiences have returned, and in the absence for those who've not been with us, Jim has been describing how the federal government has moved in and really trampled on private property, and how universities have shifted their focus in the last 3 decades from teaching their students how to manage the various resources on a genuinely sustainable way, not in the new political lingo called sustainable development, but as the word as the word has real meaning. And today, though, that behind the universities and the environmental organizations, it's no longer to manage the natural resources. It is, quote, to protect them. In other words, to keep people out from using them. Is that a fair summary of your analysis?
Exactly right. They limit the ability of private property owners to use their resources that they own, and they severely restrict more each year the use of renewable natural resources on public lands. Now, one of the prime examples of that there in the West is the increased fire danger each year from forests that are no longer managed on a routine basis to clear out the underbrush and to take trees out of certain areas in a rotational style, which ultimately is a way to have more diversity on the public lands, more different kinds of habitats for birds and snakes and lizards, as well as for deer and elk and chuckers and quail and everything else.
Our forests here can get to be so thick that deer can't traverse in through the underbrush and in between the trees. They're so thick.
Not only are they thick, but they're tending all the time when they're not managed to getting to be the same everywhere. The same growth, the same amount of growth, and the same kind of plants and the same kind of animals. And it's not a diversity. It's just one kind.
It's a monoculture.
A large area with trees, say. The difference between each year, let's say every 10 years, cutting a little, like 10 or 15% of it, maybe down completely and letting that come back naturally, and then cutting another area over here, another 10% of it selectively, which is taking out the big trees every 10 years, and doing that in a pattern across the ownership, what you've got is you've got grass over here coming in for the next 10 or 15 years, and you've got brush over there for the next 10 or 15 years, and you've got big trees over here for a long time, and you've got a diversity of birds and a diversity of all kinds of animals in there, and a pleasant landscape for people. So it's instead of everything just going to be the same heavy, thick underbrush, the same growth of trees, and you don't have a diversity. It's not. There's a lot of reasons why it's good to have grazing from ranchers and to have tree cutting available to you, as well as to generate money for the government to manage those lands, and for hunting and fishing to also be generating money and camping and that. And we're going in the opposite direction right now of trying to shut that all down.
Well, it seems so apparent, Jim, to anybody who listens to what you just said, that's just pure common sense, that a forest that's managed is one that is better than one that's left unkempt. It's no different than raising a child. If you don't mind your child, then your child grows like a weed. And if you tender that child, it grows up to be a capable and self-satisfied human being. Why is it that our Congress and that our executive department and that our universities have fallen so far astray?
Well, I would make the observation that it's been my experience from having worked for the last close to 40 years and been in Washington for about 30 of those years. It's my observation that the electorate in the United States has changed a lot in the 60s and into the 70s. I mean, a lot of social unrest. When we look at a lot of the problems we face today, we can look back to the social upheaval and a lot of the laws that were passed in the 60s and 70s. That's in the environmental area. That's when the Endangered Species Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Animal Welfare Act, the Wilderness Act were all passed by Congress. People were sold a bill of goods by these new and emerging organizations that I named earlier, the Animal Welfare Institute, the Animal Protection Institute, the Humane Society of the United States, the Wilderness Society, Greenpeace. They all kind of emerged at that time, selling this bill of goods of, oh my gosh, the world is coming to an end. There's too many people. People are developing everywhere. Wildlife is being pushed out. The trees are disappearing. We need to stop all this logging. The ranchers are out there raping the public land. And it's just awful. There's an international problem and a national problem. Send us some money and we'll help you do this. And they put out a lot of slick brochures and magazines. And even today when we turn on the TV, just the other night I was surfing across the channels and here was a nature program showing a mountain lion laying on its side, close up, licking its paw and cleaning its ear, and it looked just like your cat in the living room. And people, as they've gotten away from nature and don't live in the rural countryside, don't go up on farms anymore.
Wrap that thought. We're going to be right back here in just a few moments. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. We're going to
continue with our special guest, Mr. Jim Beers, through this other advertising break as he's describing how it is that we find ourselves in this mess that really is swamping all of America, is it not, Jim? I mean,
that's
it's
correct.
It's destroying the entire fabric of a free country, and
right.
It's certainly putting our economy at risk when we take massive amounts of land. In fact, the Wildlands Project says that we've got to take 50% of our landscape and put it off limits to human use or resource extraction. This can have no result other than to impoverish us all over a period of time. And in the meantime, we find ourselves increasingly frustrated as we lose private property if you're a rural landowner, and as we live in the cities and we find that our recreational alternatives are increasingly restricted.
That's a good point. The business about wildlife corridors and wildland projects, that's an outgrowth of wilderness. The idea that started in the 60s and 70s, oh, we need to have a few areas of wilderness where there's no roads and it's pristine nature. Actually, it's just unmanaged natural resources. But that has now grown to the point where there are people that propose formally that there be wildland projects with corridors between them, linking wild spots all over the east and all over the west, and so wildlife can go back and forth, and that's an outgrowth and an increase that was unimaginable when they first mentioned wilderness.
Like
when they first mentioned endangered species, nobody ever thought that it would be doing the things that it's doing right now, and the kind of power would be going from state governments to the federal government. It's in effect... forgetting now just for a second about these specific, the Wildland Projects Endangered Species Act and Animal Welfare Act, and these, what we're seeing is what the Constitution, what this country was built on, and the Constitution established, all of the power at the lowest possible level over our daily lives, state government and local government, where we can get politicians out much more easily if they're doing things that harm us than if they're federal politicians. A federal government is really very little different from a monarchical king, a communist dictatorship, a fascist dictatorship. When you've got all the power at one central point over the nation, you pretty much don't have power over that government.
Well,
where if you have everything as it used to be, all of the power and authority and jurisdiction at the state and local level, like the Constitution set up,
and with the individual, we're gonna rejoin our affiliate stations here in just a moment. We're here with our special guest, Mr. Jim Beers, a retired Federal Fish and Wildlife Agency person. Who has described for us the effects of the looming Wildlands Project and the consequences of shifting all the power to the federal government. And, Jim, isn't it true, too, though? I mean, from your discussion earlier, that we're not just shifting it to the federal government. We're really shifting ourselves into a global governance, because the federal government is taking its lead from these global conventions that are dictating what goes on in your county and the lands in your county and how it is that we lead our lives.
That's exactly right. But remember that our federal bureaucrats have been cooperating and colluding secretly with them in these meetings that they have with the United Nations. They get together with people from other countries. For instance, right now there's a bunch of meetings and about 2 years worth of everybody getting all excited around the world about small arms and ammunition. The problem in Africa is small arms and ammunition and all these revolutions, and this problem in the Middle East is small arms and ammunition, and the UN wants to do something about it. So they've scheduled a meeting for 2006, an international meeting about the control of small arms and ammunition. And they will propose at that meeting, no doubt, a convention on control of small arms and ammunition. And if the United States signs one of that particular convention, you can just bet your bippy that we will then pass enabling legislation here, the Small Arms and Ammunition Control Act or something to implement that treaty, and that will supersede the Second Amendment. And then think about 5, 10, 15 years of precedence and growth of the federal government. You have to pass a test, and you have to get the permission of your congressman or whatever else. The same with ammunition and all of that. That's the way the Endangered Species Act has changed the management and authority for plants and animals. And now, in the case of the Endangered Species Act, the UN bureaucrats and the federal bureaucrats in the United States, plus the university professors, are all working on getting everybody all in a dither about native ecosystems are being invaded by invasive species, and we've got to take action because native ecosystems are endangered throughout the world. This is the same malarkey they put out about eagles and elephants back when they got the Endangered Species Act passed, and most people in the city look up and they say, oh, an eagle, it's so hard, my heart just goes pitter-pat when I see one. They're in danger, we got to save them. Elephants, oh, I love elephants, I think we should save them. Right now, there are hundreds of thousands of elephants in Africa. There's 90,000 elephants in one herd alone in Tanzania. I was at a meeting in Kenya a couple of years ago. An old man from Tanzania was in tears asking me what they could do to get the UN to allow them to manage their elephants. He said they trample their crops, they've eaten the forest, he said, down to nothing. And he said they go through the villages and they trample on children and kill them. He said it's just terrible. But he said the UN restrictions because of the Endangered Species Act on elephants prevent them from doing anything with them. So that's the kind of thing that this new Invasive Species Act proposals are going on. We've got plenty of bureaucrats in Washington and plenty of university professors who see an Invasive Species Act, like they do the Endangered Species Act, as a means to get money from Congress to save these things. But in fact, it's money for them to hire more people, to do more studies, to give themselves more bonus money because they've got a bigger budget. And it's all made possible by our politicians who, as you know, like to give us medicine paid for by the government and better this and better that. So as we're concerned about these things, our congressman, our senator, are very ready to say, I just proposed the Jim Beers Invasive Species Act here in Washington to save the native ecosystems of our great state, whatever, and people clap and they say, oh, good, I'll vote for you again. So it's a kind of a vicious cycle with these radical organizations pumping out their influence and a lot of their propaganda, and the federal bureaucrats looking to build up their numbers of bureaucrats and their budgets and their power. The university professors see this, all of this, endangered species, invasive species, marine mammal protection, as a vehicle to say, well, we need to do a study on the subspecies of these seals that are going up the Columbia River because we think they're a pretty unique species. And even though there's 10 times more seals than there used to be and they're eating all the salmon, this is nature's way and we can't manage the seals or take any of the seals because we need to do more studies. We need to look at this. And I'm the seal guy at the University of Oregon or wherever, and I'm the guy that gets the money. I'm the same guy that testified that we should put this subspecies of seals on a special list and we need further study. So I get more graduate students, I get tenure, I get a bigger staff. And it's like that for all of these endangered species, invasive species. The fellow that's the specialist on the bat or the fellow that's the specialist on a certain grass or a certain tree is in fact the one who then later gets all of the grant money that Congress passes out. And then the final thing that we need to be aware of here is the state government. Our governor, our state senators and state delegates, and our state agencies. They're, for the most part, quiet throughout all of this. Occasionally, one like Wyoming will stand up on their hind legs about wolves and really take on the federal government, but they look around and none of the other states will help them fight the federal government abuses that grow yearly. The reason is that the state fish and game departments that are the ones, it's kind of the lead agency that, with the stuff we're talking about here, this environmental stuff, they are pretty dependent on hunting and fishing revenue. And they're convinced that these radical organizations are powerful enough that that they're going to take and eliminate hunting and fishing here in a few years. I don't agree with that, but the state bureaucrats pretty much all believe that. So they see their funding source from excise taxes on fishing tackle and arms and ammunition eventually drying up. So they're looking to establish new funding to not only keep their people employed that they've got, but to get more people. And the hope for the future for them is to be cooperative with the Humane Societies and the Sierra Clubs, and that as hunting and fishing are eliminated, that they sort of seamlessly transition into a world where they will be responsible for the turtles and the songbirds and all of these lesser things, and getting rid of invasive species and seeing that the animals are treated humanely and all this other kind of new wave nonsense. That's where they see their future, and the federal government is implying that they're going to fund that. If you've watched Congress for the last 15 years, every year there are proposals for non-game funding, for Conservation and Reinvestment Act funding, for Get Outdoors funding, which are all attempts to get billions of dollars from the Congress on an annual basis to be passed through the federal agencies, the Park Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Forest Service, to state agencies for specific conservation things. And that can be whatever you want it to be. A study of why you need to limit the horseback riding here because the horses go in and poop out invasive species plants and they'll spend millions of dollars looking at that. And why they need more horses over here even though the wild horses are eating everything off of the land, and why they need to get rid of grazing, and why they need to stop logging over here, as well as on private property. That's all coming. That's all down the road. And you'll have these university professors grinding out all kinds of studies about all the erosion that takes place after all logging, and you can't do anything about it, which is a lie, and the bad effects of ranchers living in the rural countryside where they disrupt the ecosystem, which is another lie, but the people in the cities, the majority of voters, will look at that stuff and say, wow, we better do something about that. I hope my federal government will save them. And the universities, as they back this stuff up, are also turning out people to go to work in the federal agencies. That, in my last 30 years, it's a dramatic change in the personnel of these federal agencies from people who understand natural resources and their renewable nature and how you can manage them and the benefits to everyone, from the logger and the rancher to the hunter and the camper and the fisherman and the grandparents that just want to take their grandkids for a picnic on public land or whatever, or the people that respect private property. They're not the kind of people that you have in the federal agencies anymore. You're having universities are turning out people who are convinced that it's bad to kill animals, it's bad to cut trees, it's just bad to go fishing, and that they should get rid of all of those fish that people want to catch and replace them with native fish that people aren't very anxious to go try and catch because they don't grow fast and whatever. And they think their job is to somehow return America to the way it was when Columbus got here. Now think about that for a minute.
Wow.
The idea that just Columbus and the Europeans are bad, and the people who were here before were, and what they had around them was good or proper or the only thing that belongs here. And that's just plain silly.
Well, it is silly, and obviously it means that if we were to live life as though it were 1492, there could be only supported a few people on this continent. And certainly these federal agents would have no prior claim to whoever's making that decision to be one of those who'd be allowed to stay. It does summon the whole idea of conservation biology. And I've looked at college programs and from Christian ones to state ones, and they all have conservation biology departments. And mm-hmm. Basically that's teaching these young people that human beings and all other species are of equal value. And that's how we get a federal agencies that have this mentality. And
And of course, it's really not about returning, which it can't be done, returning this continent to a pre-Columbian era. There are seeds in this ground that will never go away.
Amen.
And to try to drive them away is not only foolish, it is chicanery. It is only motivated by grants, by the recipient of these things, the people who are taking these jobs and these dollars for making this nonsense come true. But behind those grants, there's a socialist philosophy, and that socialist philosophy, I'm becoming increasingly convinced, and we'll be doing a show on this, is intended to bust the American dollar. And when that happens, nobody's going to be worried about that salamander or that Spanish oat weed that happens to be growing along the freeway.
Well, it's not only the salamander and the oakweed growing along the freeway. It's the same force and the same laws are going to be used to do away with your ownership of animals. And most people think now, oh, well, that's good because the farmer won't be able to abuse the calf or the pig and the chicken and all this nonsense. But in fact, they're not only targeting them, they're clearly targeting the ownership of pets to make you a guardian at first, and then to say you have no right to restrict that animal because they have rights like you do. I was at an animal rights conference about 4 years ago and wrote up a big report on it. At that conference, they had all of these groups from the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society right on down through to PETA and very, very socialist radical groups. And a woman from NARAL, the National Abortion Rights Action League, at the time, got up and gave a presentation about how she was being paid by NARAL to work 3 days a week with the Great Ape Project. And I had never heard of that, but then she went on to explain that the Great Ape Project was three or four lawyers in Washington, D.C., who were on retainer by these animal rights organizations to look for the first primate case they could find, in other words, a gorilla or a chimpanzee or orangutan, that they could take to court for having that animal abused and have the court establish the fact that that ape was entitled to all of the rights and privileges of a citizen, a human citizen of the United States. Now, you laugh at that, but then you think, well, you know, that's what they did with whales and seals. They used the argument not only that they were cute, but that they were smart, just like us, and that because they were smart, just like us, you should not kill a whale. You should not kill a seal. And then once the seal and the whale are on there, then you can say, well, the manatee goes in there, and then the manatee's in there, you can say, well, the dog certainly belongs in there, and you can say that, you just go right on down the list, and that's the intent of the animal rights organizations. And there's no reason to think, as silly as that stuff sounds, there's no reason to think that that's not going to be happening in 5 or 10 years if you look at the last 30 years.
Well, sure, because 20 years ago someone would have laughed at you that you'd lose the use of your property because of a plant or because an insect, and
yeah.
Now that happens routinely.
If you would have said that 20-some years ago, people would have said, well, that Michael, he's a crackpot, let me tell you. Don't listen to him, he doesn't know what he's talking about. And yet here we are, and it just keeps getting worse and worse, and the politicians, you know, the laws are supposed to be reauthorized every 2 to 5 years or gotten rid of. And the Endangered Species Act has not been reauthorized for over 15 years. And the reason is, you've got on one side, you've got people who have actually been stung by this thing and see how bad it is, who are screaming, you better change that, you better stop what it's doing to private property, you better stop what it's doing about putting wolves out there and getting rid of our elk hunting and killing my dog and all this stuff. And then you've got all the other people that are, you know, ready to run to the ramparts and say, oh, you can't touch it. It needs to be tightened up because things are just getting worse. There's too many people. We're running out of wildlife. And these are the same people, for instance, that when a cougar or a wolf or a coyote attacks a child in a city and sometimes kills him or kills a bicyclist, turn around and say this, it just drives me up a wall, this goofy thing about, oh, they were in the animal's habitat. The United States is our habitat, and these animals and plants exist where they do and in the abundance they do at our discretion. And we are more and more turning away from that concept and saying, oh, that cougar is here where we used to ride our bikes, so I guess we shouldn't ride our bike there anymore. When people complain about it, these bureaucrats who we pay will come out with this nonsense about, well, if you see a grizzly bear, you're supposed to puff up and look him in the eye and don't run and roll up in a ball and all this other goofy, goofy stuff. At the same time, they tell us not to even have a gun if we're near there. As though we're no better than that animal, and that somehow that animal's rights are in any way equal to ours to be in a certain location. That's just crazy.
Well, you know, a long time ago, Jim, I was told that the beginning of the 21st century was going to be the war on reason, and I thought that was a crazy prognostication. But we're seeing it happen, and you've provided incredible evidence that is moving through our society at an incredible rate, and people are still lapping in the luxury of dollars, and that's dangerous. We're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station in just a moment. We're back while some stations are off for a commercial break with our special guest, Mr. Jim Beers, talking about the Endangered Species Act, the Invasive Species Act, and the philosophical premise that's really bringing America down as our citizenry has bought the chicanery and the baloney, and our universities are graduating people who have lost their sense of reason as they just implement mandated rules that take property and are destroying the fabric of this country. Jim, what thoughts might you have about how it is we can take some initial steps to restore the sanity and engage in this war on reason in a constructive way?
Well, I write and think about this a lot, and I think a couple of suggestions are we've got to elect state politicians, governor, state senator, and state delegate, whatever you call them, who will stand up for the constitutional rights of our state, in spite of the fact that they get millions of dollars in highway money from the federal government, and that the grant money from the federal government for the Fish and Game Department comes through federal agencies. That's a terrible hammer hanging over their head, and they tend to be very reticent about taken on the federal government for fear that they will have their highway money held up or their grant money for this held up or just be given a lot of trouble. But we need to hire, or elect actually, good, strong state politicians that will defend our state the way we want it to be. Now that's one thing. Then we've got to vote in federal politicians who are concerned with and have the gumption to stand up to this stuff and change these laws. And that may mean some specific sections get amended and other sections simply get repealed. When we passed Prohibition, we decided after about 10 years of watching that was a bad law. And even though it had passed, changed the Constitution and become an amendment, we repealed it. So the idea that it's sacred that we do all the things that we're doing right now under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Animal Welfare Act, is nonsense. The idea that this is all inevitable progress and that we're somehow becoming more enlightened than our parents and grandparents is silly. Silly
stuff. If we continue on that path, we're going to learn the lesson the hard way. We're about ready to return to our all of our stations, but we also have a caller from Santa Cruz, Bill, who's on the line, and just hold yourself a moment here, Bill. We'll be right back with you at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. Well, we're here with our special guest, Mr. Jim Beers, discussing the how it is that we can resurrect freedom in this country and liberty and go down a path where we're working to preserve that and not a salamander. And we have on the phone here Bill calling from Santa Cruz. Bill, what's your question or comment, Mr. Beers?
Well, several, but I'll narrow it down. I'm in agreement with the gentleman, and I think what you mentioned about the war on reason, these are just examples that the war has been lost. A woman was attacked by a mountain lion in Southern California several years ago, and she had children, and the mountain lion had cubs, and the donations to the Mountain Lion Fund far exceeded the donations to the woman's orphan children. And when you say we have to vote people in, that's who's voting. And my main point was when you mentioned earlier that the federal government is more like a monarchy, the clue really lies in who donated Washington, D.C. real estate as a federal government?
The state of Virginia and Maryland, originally, just the Maryland part is what D.C. is made up of right now.
Well, who donated it?
Well, as I understand it, it was requested by the federal government.
There was no federal government when it was donated. It was donated by a man named Pope. Okay, he called his property the New Rome. And a good clue as to what's going on in this country is the Columbia Law University. And do you know who administers that?
Is that the Columbia University up in New York?
In Washington, D.C.
I think Columbia is in New York.
No, I'm thinking, what's the law school in Washington, D.C.? There, the big one.
Well, it's Georgetown.
Georgetown, I'm sorry. I didn't mean Columbia. Georgetown University. Who administers that?
But Georgetown's a Catholic university.
Exactly. It's a Jesuit university, and it's packing our government with people who want to destroy this country.
Well, Bill, certainly the country is wanting to be destroyed, but this is beyond the range of tonight's discussion on the Endangered Species Act, etc., and it's certainly more than coming from a single focus. But I'd sure encourage you to communicate these thoughts and some specificity to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, and we'd look forward to getting that. And we're wrapping up into the last couple minutes here, Jim, of our show tonight, and what is it that you would leave with our audience as sort of a final message about the issues we've been talking about here?
I think ultimately you got to consider that you have to get the federal bureaucracy back under the control of elected politicians, and that means both state and federal politicians. The federal bureaucracy is a lot of the problem, and not that they're evil or bad people; they're just motivated by the same things that motivate the rest of us. But they have become a large problem in that they're dealing with UN bureaucrats and with these radical organizations with these radical agendas, because that feeds the budgets and the power of these federal agencies. And as they build their power, they concentrate power that the Constitution had left much closer to the people. They concentrate that all at one place in Washington, D.C. And that is a very, very dangerous situation.